session number 17329, reel 3.
Mr. McHenry, reel 3.
Yes, we'd arrived at the winter in a static position. We weren't moving one way or the other, and the ground was very difficult. Lots of snow about, quite deep in places, so you couldn't make much progress, and of course the tanks were had slowed up. We were in front of a huge hill called Monte Soli during the Christmas of 44, and the Germans were occupying this mountain, and the object was to get them off there, of course. But it was a very difficult job. It was virtually steep. A frontal attack was very steep, and we would have had a lot of casualties, because he could have just stood up there and knocked us for six. Well, three times we were ready for the attack. We knew what we had to do, along with the other regiments. And three times it was called off. And in the end, they called the whole thing off. And shortly afterwards, we moved across Italy over to the east coast. For a while, through the winter, through December and January, we sat in front of this Monte Soli, just looking at it and doing nothing really. But once we moved over to the east coast, we knew that the push was coming up there, and it's a flat area where we were, full of canals and swamps and marshes, and it's a different kind of fighting altogether. We started training in landing craft, because I think they had every intentions of putting us in these boats and going round the Germans up the coast. However, it didn't quite work out that way. We battled our way through these canals, kept on chasing him, and he kept on trying to stop us. But a few hair-raising things went on during that run, a lot of casualties as well. And this continued all the way up the east coast. He kept running backwards and we kept chasing him, stopping every now and again, until we reached the River Po. Well, he'd been dropping pamphlets on us by this time, warning us what was going to happen when we reached this river. And on the pamphlets it described that he would be sitting on the opposite bank, and when we came across in boats, he'd just sink the lot of us. However, when we reached the River Po, things seemed to have died down a bit. Everything went very quiet. But nevertheless, it wasn't a very pleasant feeling when we started to cross this river in these boats. But nothing happened, fortunately. And we reached the other side and got ready to move up the road again. And we were lying on the banks of the Po at this time. And the word came through that the Germans had capitulated in Italy. And that was the end of the war as far as the 1st Battalion were concerned in that part of the world.
Do you think those pamphlets, those leaflets had much effect?
Not really. During the time we were sitting in front of Monte Soli, he kept dropping leaflets on us there. And at Christmas time, telling us, why didn't we give in? Christmas is coming, and if any of us got killed, it would break the family's heart back at home. So we were quite used to reading these things. He was also dropping pamphlets on us. At this time, the battle over in Germany was going on, and the paratroopers had got into trouble in Arnhem, and he was dropping pamphlets on us, telling us all about the casualties that the paratroopers had come across in Arnhem. So we were quite used to reading these things. It didn't make much impression on us at all. Not that we could do very much about it anyway. You see, you in a battalion, in a company, in a section, you don't see an awful lot of what is going on in the rest of the world outside you. You're concentrated on your own little party, doing what you have to do and coming out of it in one piece. So you never knew really what was going on in the rest of the world. Just generally, you knew what was going on.
Did you get to be superstitious at all?
Yeah, I did. I thought fate would sort something out in the end. I'd become a bit fatalistic, that if it had your name on it, that you would never be able to dodge it anyway. I came very close during the latter stages. Two or three times I thought that this was it, but fortunately, one particular point on a canal, motoring us on this canal bank, and we had there were 18 men on that canal bank, and the six casualties out of that 18, which was quite a lot really, because we'd been fighting for quite a long time up there and just getting the odd casualty. But at this particular point we had a lot of casualties, and the two chaps alongside me were killed. And there wasn't a mark on them. It was the shock that killed them. A shock of a mortar bomb landing on water killed these two men without a mark on them. And I got a piece of shrapnel, but I was lucky. It went into my... we had canvas anklets on, and it went through the canvas anklets and through the sock, just scratched the skin. So I kept thinking, well, that wasn't meant for me.
So this mortaring must have been on the east coast of Italy.
Yeah.
In 45.
In 45, yes.
But when I said, were you superstitious, I meant, did you have anything like lucky charms or rituals that you went through to keep your luck up?
Used to carry a metal mirror in my blouse pocket.
Over your heart?
Over my heart, yeah. Which, strangely enough, I wore the same thing when I was first wounded. But I'd taken it out of my pocket to put into... They have a pocket on the left leg. A deep pocket. I put it in there, and when that booby trap went off, there was a piece hit that metal and didn't go through. I took it out of there because I had I'd put some Tommy gun
bullet
in my top pocket so as I could get at them easy, so as they wouldn't rattle when I moved. Some magazines, some Tommy gun magazines in my two blouse pockets.
So the object of the mirror in your breast pocket was a lucky charm, was it? Or you thought?
I suppose so, yes.
Any other superstitions that you had?
Not that I can recall, no.
What condition were you in by the time VE Day came?
Very pleased that it was over, because we'd had quite a lot of what we call bomb happy people on the way through. You know, people who had got very nervous and couldn't stand the strain. We used to call them bomb happy, which was not unusual, because when you're sitting on the top of a hill in a trench and it's bitterly cold and the Germans are not very far away from you, and this goes on night after night, day after day, week after week, and you're doing two on and two off, 2 hours on and 2 hours off, it gets a bit nerve-wracking in the end, because you visualise all kinds of things when you're sitting up there on the hillside and thinking what's going to happen next. So some of them, nerves got the better of them.
What symptoms would they show to indicate that they had bomb happiness?
They would be always digging deeper so as to protect themselves from any fire from the enemy. Always wanting to know what was happening next, and some of them wanted to go back, and they would fake an illness of some kind. Say they weren't feeling well and they wanted to go back to the sick bay.
Were you told to look out for things like that by the officers?
Not really. We were very close-knit company, really. I mean, you knew what was going on round about you all the time. You knew the people who were frightened. You tried to protect them as much as you could, but you can only go so far. Once the shells start dropping round about you, you know, virtually you have to look after yourself to a great extent.
But how could you look after the nervous ones? Giving them easier jobs?
Not really. You just have to talk to them, try and ease them down. You used to find that one particular chap I had with me, when he was on sentry, he would come and wake me up every half hour or so and say, "I've heard somebody here. Will you come and listen with me for a moment?" You knew what he was on about. He hadn't heard any. He just wanted you there to reassure him that everything was all right. During one action round about this canal, we had some reserves sent up to us, and these lads were only young, only 19 years of age. They'd come from the RAF regiment and they'd been recruited into the Guard regiment, which was quite a different thing altogether, and thrown right into action, which they'd never seen any action before this. Extremely nervous fellow, this poor lad was. You virtually had to lead him by the hand, take him round with you, you know. He just didn't know what was going on, and it is a bit nerve-wracking when you be continually under fire all day long. It's very nerve-wracking. I suppose we got used to it, really. The older soldiers that had been abroad for 3-4 years out there kind of got used to it. Some easier than others.
Sounds that somebody like that would not really be of any use to you.
No, they would crouch down in the trench when they were supposed, you had to drag them out sometimes.
I mean, if he was waking you up every half hour, it would be very easy to get snappy with him.
Wasn't so much the waking up, it was the hand on the shoulder, which your bottle used to go, I think, a little bit. You'd suddenly, you didn't know whether it was your man or a German saying, hey, come on, follow me. Yeah, it was a bit nerve-wracking.
Were there any special celebrations on VE Day?
In VE Day, we were in Trieste. And Trieste at that time was occupied by Tito and his men. And they had a curfew on the place, on the town. You weren't allowed out after 10 o'clock. And he had his troops all stationed all over the town. So the VE celebrations were a little bit on the quiet side. He celebrated by firing tracer bullets all over the town all night long. We just stayed in the hotel where we were billeted. It wasn't worthwhile going out on the streets with these people firing anywhere and everywhere.
Where were you stationed in Trieste?
Yes, in a hotel.
What was the name of it?
Can't remember.
Somewhere right in the middle?
On the dock side, it was. I have a card up, which would tell you the name of it.
What instructions were you given regarding the Titoists?
None, really. Until he went away, it was just garrison duties, really. We were free to walk around during the day, but we were a bit restricted. But eventually, it came to an agreement, and Tito, they moved them out into the Yugoslavia.
What was the attitude of the Titoists towards you?
Very belligerent at first. They didn't trust us, and I don't suppose we trusted them to a great extent. But you had to realise that they'd been in a peculiar kind of war themselves, really. And the occupation of Trieste dated back, I believe, to 1914, when this part of the world was given to Italy for some reason or other, and they thought they would like it back again, and they thought this was the opportunity to get it back again.
Were they threatening towards you at first?
Well, what they did was they occupied the main square in Trieste, put a machine gun on it on the four corners to stop any troubles that arose, and they also had a section of men and women marching round your hotel all day long, just making it awkward. That was all they did.
Were they shouting or firing?
No. But that, to say, they had a curfew at 10 o'clock. They wouldn't allow you to be on the streets after 10 o'clock. And you didn't give them the opportunity to fire at you anyway. Kept a low profile.
Were there any disturbances in Trieste?
Yes, quite a few.
What form did they take?
Well, the Italians didn't like the Yugoslavians and vice versa. So they raided the Italian embassy, the Yugoslavians, and they burnt all the papers, and then the Italians did the same to them. They turn over the trams in the street and have marching through the streets shouting slogans. And by this time we were based in in the Rossetti barracks, and we were there just to keep the peace, really.
Did you have policing or law and order duties?
Yes, we were basically the law and order in the town.
How did you perform it?
We used to guard all the various offices the main offices, we would guard the docks. That's all we were doing, really. 24-hour guards on all the specific places that we occupied, that were necessary to the troops in Trieste to keep going.
Did you ever have to disperse any mobs or crowds?
No, eventually the police force came into operation, and it was the police really that took the brunt of the crowd control in the end.
Were the police Italians or Yugoslavs?
Italians, in British uniforms.
Did that cause any problems?
No.
Did you see anything of anybody being forced to return to Yugoslavia who didn't want to?
No. We spent 6 months in Yugoslavia at that time, in a place called Pola, which is called Pula now, but it's Pola then. just doing the same thing, garrison duties.
What was it like there?
Well, we were based in an old submarine base, submarine training school, which was away from the centre of the town, so we didn't have any problems. And I wasn't doing guard duties at this time, because I'd been promoted considerably since then.
Was it a pleasant place to be at?
It was, yes. Trieste was a very good station, because it hadn't been touched by the enemy. And there was everything a soldier required there, really.
Because this is a seaside place now.
Yep.
For tourists.
Yep.
Was there any discontent about the speed of demobilisation?
No.
Were people agitated about it?
No. Because by this time it was, this period, they were going home pretty quick. Because we'd been abroad quite some time with it.
When were you demobilised?
1947.
Why so late?
I'd signed on for 7 years. And the 7 years was up. Actually, I did more than 7 years, but that's the way it worked out.
Were you offered the chance of staying on?
Yep. Yes.
Why did you not take it?
The various reasons, I suppose. By this time, 2 years after the war had finished, most of the chaps I'd served with had gone home. And the soldiers replacing them were, what do you call it, 2 year men. And I don't know, it wasn't the same. Everybody, well, practically everybody I knew had gone. And the chaps coming out, they didn't want to be soldiers. They knew they had only had 2 years to do, and that was it. They were just filling in their time, basically.
How do you think you would have coped with the normal ceremonial duties that guardsmen have?
Well, I didn't do any. I was quite capable of doing it. By this time, I was a company sergeant major. I had a company to look after. And I could cope all right. We did a trooping of the colour out in Trieste at one period, which was the same as they do in London now. No, there was no problem coping with the ceremonial side.
Going back to 1941, when you were in Pirbright, I think you've got some information about guarding Rudolf Hess there.
Yes, when we were the demonstration platoon, we were sent down to, well, Hess came down to an area near the regimental military police headquarters, where he occupied a house. He was inside the house. There was an internal ring occupied by the military police, and an external ring which was occupied by us. We spent 3 weeks there. During that time, he jumped, he was two floors up, and he jumped down the staircase, and what we heard was he attempted to commit suicide, but he only broke an ankle. The inside of the house was occupied by officers of the regiment, and we just guarded the outside. And then we moved on.
What kind of reputation did he have amongst the British soldiers?
Well, we didn't get inside the house or inside the ring, the internal ring. So we didn't see him at all, because once he'd broken his ankle, he was confined to the house anyway. So he never did come outside.